Welcome to Packet Pushers, a podcast on the data networking industry where real engineers get together to talk oh so very nerdy. A place where we sneak up on the networking security risks and capture them with our little Ethernets, stick them into little jars which we then parade around the office for PCI compliance purposes in an ITIL approved way. This process, of course, is also known as network security. Today's show is sponsored by Avaya Networks, and we are taking a deep dive on stealth networking. And this, let me just give you a sneak preview, it's a look at segmentation, which is one of the hottest topics in networking today in the Avaya Fabric Connect technology group that's enabled by shortest path bridging. But before we start washing ourselves and lathing our wondrous bodies in the magic of technology, I'd like to welcome Mr. Banks to the show. How are you, sir?
You threw me off with the wondrous bodies part at that point, because the only thing wondrous about my body is the amount of weight I've gained since joining IT. I'll tell you what, 20 years will do a bad thing to a tech person's body. You got to be really careful about that stuff.
I'd like to thank all of the vendors and corporate expense accounts for making this body what it is today.
That's right. Exactly right.
Proud of it, too.
Yeah. Exactly right. And that voice in the background is Ed Kohler. Ed, introduce yourself to the audience, please.
Hi, guys. I'm Ed Kohler. I'm with Avaya, and I'm a distinguished engineer in the Avaya networking group.
You know, when you say distinguished, I've got visions of this big mustache with points on the end. I'm a distinguished engineer.
It just means I get to wear a tweed jacket with the
leather patches.
With the elbow patches, exactly.
Yeah. let's park on that for just a second, Ed, because if you are a distinguished engineer, that is actually notable in the industry. It means you've achieved some sort of recognition and achievement from your employer, yes?
Actually, from my peers. A distinguished engineer in Avaya has to be voted on and arrived at by a sequence of voting from engineering peers. And that's actually a global process. So, it is quite an honor to actually have that title.
Mm, very interesting. Ooh.
Peer acclaim is the sweetest acclaim of all, surely.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I could use some of that, Ethan.
Well, we'll have a vote, you and me, and see how it turns out.
All right, so let's get on with the meat of today's show. So, Ed, the topic of stealth networking doesn't immediately lend itself to saying, yeah, I know exactly what they're talking about, move on. So let's kick off by telling me what is stealth networking and break it down a little bit for me.
Well, as you guys know, there's a lot of concern about privacy and security. I don't need to go through the attacks on power grids, the attempts of confidential information, and then people who attack networks just for the heck of it, just to see if they can take them down. And the problem that we see is that things are getting much more sophisticated. One of the things that we've arrived at is that one of the key issues of networking is the fact that we use IP to establish service paths. And because we do this, these techniques can be evolved where someone can actually, over time, learn the topology of your network. And by learning the topology of your network, they can gain knowledge as to certain key routers or switches that if they take out, they can hurt you. But it also allows them to identify attack vectors and things of that nature, which eventually lead to compromising of the security perimeter.
Hmm. So stealth, when we talk about security strategies at the networking, focusing on things like defense in depth, layered defenses.
Yeah. In the analogy that I like to use when I talk about it is similar to military reconnaissance. When you enter into a certain geography, if you want to do it stealthy, you need to brush your trail. And that's a very difficult thing to do. If you look at someone who's just starting to learn how to do that, the brush trail is often more obvious than the tracks themselves, because you really have to pay attention not only to the footprints, but, you know, breaking of foliage, errant footprints, things of that nature, where if you look at someone who's really a master, they strew debris, they make it look very, very natural. But even an expert tracker will spot something, and that gives them vectors to start tracking. It's the same analogy here in the fact that we're using IP to establish the service paths, and then we're trying to hide the paths that we're establishing. But think about it, guys. There's only so much you can hide it, because IP needs visibility in order to actually perform its routing function. So this becomes a bit of a catch-22 in networking. So what stealth technology really is it's a path technology that really doesn't use IP.
Yeah, exactly, right? And because so many of the technologies that we use today for carving the network up into smaller chunks, because what you're trying to do here when you talk about security in the network is you're trying to create segments. Is it, you use the word segments when you refer to this segmentation?
Absolutely.
So to me, the idea that I come into with network security is that I want to be able to create a segment. And the idea is that if I was to attack a web server in the DMZ, and I can do a privesc, I can get a privilege escalation, so I can go from user mode to root mode and then own the box. Right? Once I own the box, the next thing I'm going to do is go horizontal. I'm going to try and compromise other boxes in the DMZ so that I've now got two or three servers in the DMZ, and then one of those is going to be able to reach into the core, into the GUI center, and be able to start to grab data so I can start to use those servers. Now, in segmentation, I want to be able to create smaller and smaller zones, so that if I can pop a privesc on a box in the external zone, my abilities to move horizontal inside of the zone is limited because there's lots of smaller zones. And this is where segmentation is incredibly valuable in terms of providing network security. Now, networking, of course, and Ed, you know this, is really hard to achieve. That's just not something we can do because networking wasn't built that way.
That's right. When you look at it, IP really was developed around the rose-colored glasses phenomenon. The internet, free for all, free for everyone. And that's a nice vision. It's hopefully we can epitomize that someday with our human cultures. But I think you'll all agree that we are a good deal away from that. There's a lot of nefarious use of the internet. we just have to realize that IP as a protocol was never really designed with security in mind.
Or Ethernet.
Or Ethernet, for that matter. Right. Exactly.
So, even there's a layer of abstraction between IP and Ethernet. Ethernet itself was designed to connect things. It wasn't designed to prevent things from being connected at the same time.
That's just it. The whole goal here is reachability. The whole goal is connectivity of the internet just in basic principles. So assuming reachability, then someone's got an attack surface that they can go after. Now, going back to what you were saying earlier as you were defining stealth networking, Ed, you said we use IP to make data paths between endpoints, and if it's IP, then usually that path can be discovered. But with stealth networking, there is a data path that's formed, but it isn't IP. But yet these IP endpoints can talk to each other still.
Correct. And we refer to that path as an Ethernet switched path. And that's why I did want to kind of add in that while Ethernet itself, and we're talking just normal 802.3 and 802.1d, is a fairly promiscuous protocol. It floods. It learns by flooding. It establishes all services by some sort of promiscuous behavior. And when you look at it, that's very analogous to what IP does. And it's these promiscuous behaviors that most attackers will leverage. And this is the key. Whereas, an Ethernet switch path is more held in an integrated layer, and there is no concept of flooding within shortest path bridging. And this is one of the reasons why it tends to be very secure and tends to lend itself very well to being locked down. Because if I have an integrated database instance of a service, there's no way the traffic can be routed outside of that segment, as you said, Greg.
Yeah. So this most people would know would be thinking at the moment of MPLS, and you're using, IP VPNs with an MPLS tag in the IP header, or Verf Lite by, using the MPLS functions internally to the device to create pseudo segments that are manually configured, or one of the automated versions of the MPLS stuff, right? But the thing about MPLS is that it usually works at the IP layer. It doesn't work at the Ethernet layer.
That's right.
You still have a vulnerability, even though you're using IP MPLS on an interface, you still have a vulnerability or an attack surface around the Ethernet interface of the router. You can sometimes hijack, you're going to pop a router interface. This is less likely today than it used to be, but, we do occasionally have these problems. But Avaya's Fabric Connect uses an IEEE standard 802.1AQ. Now, we've done previous shows on shortest path bridging. We've done quite a few over the last couple of years. It's just to recap, they just know that it's a layer 2 ECMP protocol that looks like Trill but works completely differently to Trill. And it's from the IEEE, so it's quite standardized. And in this case, we are using the 802.1IQ for what you'd say here is circuit-based capabilities. How does that work?
That is correct. If you look at the the internet documents or the IEEE documents, it's referred to as a constrained service. And what we mean by constrained services are basically circuit-based services. And they are scoped to the service points of presence that are members of that given circuit. So let's say I create a network and I want to segment it down. I can create multiple segments for multiple purposes. I can create a closed environment for PCI. We have many hospitals that are using it for HIPAA compliance. We have many transit authorities that are using it for secure control of tracks, subways, environmental monitoring, things of that nature. And then we also have many manufacturers that are now starting to use it for automated production flows.
The idea here is that we're building out a shortest path bridging fabric and then assigning different endpoints into different services so that they are contained. So they can all be sharing the same physical fabric, but yet contained from one another, similar to what MPLS would do, is to go back to Greg's analogy earlier. Is that right, Ed?
The analogy is very close to MPLS, without the complexities and without the need to have all those supporting underlying protocols. We replace that wedding cake of protocols, if you will, which is my favorite term. anyone want a slice? we replace it really with an integrated database, and that integrated database is held by each and every shortest path bridging switch. And this is basically where the replication comes in, because one of the reasons why I have the title of Distinguished Engineer is I happen to be one of the key contributors to the way shortest path bridging replicates. And if I can talk about that for a second.
Please do.
We don't flood. So when someone ARPs into a network, now obviously it generates an Ethernet frame and it's all Fs. An Ethernet switch just floods it everywhere within the scope of a VLAN. Really what happens here is that while these circuits, these constrained segments, are somewhat analogous to a VLAN, they're not, because they're not flooding domains. There is no broadcast activity. What happens is we replicate statefully and deterministically according to the database instantiations. And this is a key difference, because once we start doing that, there is no way that you can have an errant packet forward it. There's no way you can have topological loops. There's no way that you can spoof an incoming traffic train without the ability to actually be a service point of presence on the network. And this is one thing an attacker does not want to do, become public into the network and actually be seen within the database. So this is one of the key contributions that SPB brings to the table. Now, is it a comprehensive security story in and of itself? No, of course not. We still need intrusion detection. We still need firewalls. But what happens is, by this very strong, stateful, deterministic segmentation, we can allow for the collapsing of security perimeters and the virtualization of them. So that now, rather than having firewalls everywhere where I have security policy databases and I need to coordinate those, I can collapse it down into a certain demarcation point and then bring the segmentation to that segmentation point. And we have many folks that have actually done quite a bit of modifications of their security perimeter by the introduction of Fabric Connect.
In other words, you're talking about consolidating firewalls, if we're talking about firewalls or some kind of a next-gen device that's doing deep packet inspection. Rather than having lots and lots of them out there between segments, you're talking about collapsing that down into a smaller number of devices, maybe one device that is governing traffic going between segments?
Yes. And let me go further on that. Let's take a zero-day threat anomaly-based intrusion detection system. If one of the common complaints of those systems is, if you just put it at the data center DMARC in front of the core network, it just generates a lot of white noise because everything looks like an anomaly.
Yes.
And this is a big complaint.
Yes, you just condemned an entire industry.
Exactly. So-called security experts so many times.
You know, and here you are, you're looking at this white noise and you're trying to say, okay, what's really a threat out of this? But think about this now. When you look – and let's use PCI, credit cards as an example. When you look at a retail outlet, there's a certain known orchestrated flow for the way the cardholder data moves. And it moves from the point of sale up to the upload where the bank gets a hold of the transaction, or some people do store, although it's not recommended in PCI, some people do store credit card data. The point of the matter is that there's a very well-known flow, and there's a very well-known set of community that participate in that traffic flow. And now when you put an IDS against a stealth segment that is dedicated just to PCI traffic, anything that is an anomaly will stick out like a sore thumb. Any errant flows. You know, why is this database server suddenly talking to this end system? It's never done that before. The database really shouldn't be talking to anybody outside of the data center. Why is that happening? And if you think about it, you know, if we think about many of the recent infringements into the retail sector, that's exactly what happens, is the malware typically gets loaded into a point of sale. And then through the flow of the cardholder data, it finds its way into the data center where, as you pointed out, Ethan, you know, the horizontal movement can begin to occur. And actually, that's a replay of what happened at Target.
All right. So now we've got a bit of a grip on how stealth networking, so this idea of segmentation, the smaller you can make your segments at a practical way. And I mean, the thing about this idea of using shortest path bridging to create segments is actually quite practical, because you don't have to configure protocols like BGP and LDP and all this sort of stuff. It's actually just all part of the SBB configuration. You really just configure one VLAN. Is it called? It's not called a VLAN. It's called what is it, Ed?
A virtual service network.
That's it. Virtual service network. And then the switch is sort of auto-configured, because the configuration around that area actually propagates as part of the Fabric Connect protocol, right?
That's correct.
Yep. Yeah, the exactly. VSN, as I recall, is based on an ISID, and you map an ISID to a VLAN. Is that?
Well, you can map an ISID to a VLAN, and that creates a layer 2 network. And creating a stealth network is really nothing more than just not giving IP addresses to the VLANs. We have many transit authorities that actually use that type of topology to move SCADA, which is stands for Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition, which is the primary protocol used to control, you know, trains, subways, infrastructure, things that you don't want people going in and messing with. And really what happens by creating an L2 stealth network is we create this bounded, constrained environment where all of the SCADA programmable logic controllers and the human management interface to manage that environment are all contained within this segment. There's no way in, there's no way out. Okay.
And that's what happens at the Ethernet layer. You can't, you know, forge sources, or it's very difficult to hack.
No, you can't. We actually have some security assessors who have been working for a number of weeks. And I'm saying number of weeks now. We're going back to the end of June, and they have been mounting various attack methodologies. And the only way that they've been able to actually get inside a stealth network is by getting into the management network and actually assigning a port. But as we all know, people should protect their management networks, which, by the way, we recommend you use stealth technologies to do that. now there is another version of an ISID, though. You can take an ISID and associate it with a VRF, a virtual route forwarding engine. That's what we call a layer 3 stealth. And that really is equivalent to an RFC 4364 MPLS service. The difference, obviously, is we don't need the underlying substrates. We replace BGP, we replace route targets, the distinguishers, and everything else, all with that muckety-muck, with one element, and that's the ISID. Yeah. So what we found is feedback from many qualified security assessors is they like the technology because rather than trying to audit, you know, a 100 to 120 line configuration of an MPLS instance, they can do the same thing with as little as a dozen command lines with an L3 VSN. So they like it because it's easier to audit. It's easier to monitor for consistency. And as we all know, when you're doing security, consistency is key. So this is just some of the additional capabilities that we brought to the table on top of the actual IEEE standard itself.
In other words, for shortest path bridging, the mapping an ISID to a VRF is extra avaya magic.
That's correct. Now, I do want to emphasize, though, that it is reflected by a series of IETF documents, namely Draft Unbehagen, which is Paul Unbehagen, a colleague of mine.
Yeah, Paul's been on the show several times. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. And Draft Unbehagen calls out the ability for layer 3 VSNs. the ability to do IP routing, stealth over the network infrastructure, and then also multicast. Drahtenbehagen gives the ability to run multicast. So in reality, you can run a stealth multicast environment, which is fairly unique in the industry.
Yeah, we covered that in a previous show. So if you're interested in that, we'll try and get that into the show notes. I think that was the last one a few weeks back where we talked about how – no, the one about the Shockey Olympics and how we did that multicast there over SBB. Yep. So let's talk about how customers are using this, Ed. So you've been working with customers in this technology. What are the kind of customers who are interested in this technology, and what are you working – what are the sorts of projects – and you can't tell us exactly what's going on, but broadly tell us what's the sort of applications that customers are using this for.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, some of them are obvious. You know, state and local governments, transit authorities, airports. And then also, increasingly, we're getting use not only within the U.S. military, but we're getting a lot of interest from military organizations globally around the technology. There is also a growing area of interest in healthcare, and we have several hospitals that are using the technology in various fashions, either to do the micro-segmentation for non-security services. So in other words, they really just want to keep these things separate so that they don't, you know, trounce on one another, as the saying goes. But then some, like HIPAA compliance, patient records, and believe it or not, some hospitals will actually take credit cards at the bedside now, believe it or not. And obviously, you need to be PCI compliant for that type of activity. So they're using it in various fashions. Retail is another obvious area. But then increasingly, we're seeing automated production flows where, again, security is very, very key. Because a good example is an automotive manufacturer. You know, if a flow goes down, it's literally millions and millions of dollars per minute that they're losing. So stability and security are somewhat important.
Yeah, those manufacturing systems, if they go wrong, you can have piles of equipment actually being mangled into useless chunks of metal.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah. Very quick.
And so some of what you said there sort of says, you know, there's a lot of use cases for segmentation. There's the security use case, which is kind of obvious, right? Creating lots of – instead of having just one big VLAN in the data center or one big layer 3 space in the center of your data center, making what some people call the, you know, the gooey core or the, you know, the crunchy middle, what you can do is start to chunk your data center up into ever smaller pieces. But it equally applies to the campus. So if you're on a campus network and you want to be able to create a lot more segmentation out there, you know, say by department, by division, by manufacturing, you know, like this production line, that production line, but still have one physical infrastructure, this is the sort of applications. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is. And we refer to those as tenants, by the way. And tenants can be not only departments or companies or customers. They can be applications. Yep. So you can say, hey, I've got this one application that I want to have separate, and I want to make sure it has its own walled garden, as the saying would go. That is another key, is that, you know, you have to think of tenants in a broader sense.
Ed, let's talk a little bit about the I want to talk about the firewall architecture for just a minute now. We were talking about building out all these segments, building out all these tenants, if you will, whether they're at layer 2 or layer 3. They get mapped into an ICID, and then they're separate from one another. And if they need to contact one another, we're going to push them through this now centralized security device. So what does that security device look like? Does he have multiple interfaces, one for each segment? And so traffic kind of egresses the via fabric, hits this firewall deep packet inspection device, and then gets routed and forwarded back in, or?
That's one option. It depends on the level of security required. If it's simply segmentation and they're just looking to keep communities separate, many times they'll use a single interface and they'll just identify different VLANs, VIDs, and that's sure, how the segmentation occurs. However, If security is really a prime concern, then many times they'll use a dedicated interface off the firewall for that purpose. It will terminate the actual virtual service network to that interface, and that will become a dedicated member of that VSN and only a member of that VSN. And you're right. Anytime communication needs to happen outside of that environment, if you choose to allow it, it would happen through that secure demarcation point.
Now, what about when we're getting into securing virtual environments where you've got, say it's a VMware cluster and there's a number of virtual machines and each of them are, you could have a scattering of virtual hosts or of guests that are participating in different segments of this stealth network. What's the handoff look like coming from a VMware host into an Avaya Fabric?
You know, that's an interesting subject that you bring up, because if you read some of the documentation around VXLAN, there's a whole section towards the end that goes over various security concerns with the protocol. One of the things that ISITs do is they can actually provide a virtual LAN extension somewhat equivalent to VXLAN. As a matter of fact, if you look at it, VXLAN uses a 24-bit field to identify VXLAN IDs. Yes. ISITs use the same 24-bit field, not the same field, but also use a 24-bit field,
yeah.
Which means you've got a one-for-one match. So you could look at the handoff as being, you know, we would actually extend a VXLAN environment through the use of the ISIT. The benefit here is that we don't give any IP personality to that environment. So now you can have the ability to move virtual machines between two data centers, for instance, across the ISIT, but there's no traceability to the IP paths. The only way the IP path knowledge could be even gained is by access to the management and the ability to actually see the database environment.
Now, is that, I was trying to determine, is that theoretical that you were talking about? This could be done, or is this something Avaya is actually doing?
That is something we're working on. We're actually working on a VXLAN gateway that would actually do the translation. Today, what we do is we terminate VLANs, VIDs from the VMware environment once it's exposed on a physical network adapter, and then we would associate that with an ISIT. Today, we automate that by the use of a virtual provisioning service, and that indeed will evolve into a VXLAN gateway.
Got it. That makes sense. That adds up. Just trunking down to the Avaya switch, then handing off to an ISIT is very straightforward and easy to see how that worked today. I was curious that VXLAN is working. Not yet.
Not yet. But when you think about it, you know, that's one of the beauties of an IEEE standard is that gives you the lowest common denominator, which everyone complies to. If you're doing networking, you comply to IEEE.
So have you interacted with VMware NSX, which could be, I see these as potentially quite complementary technologies.
It's funny you mention that. I'm actually involved in a series of meetings with VMware right now discussing how we can work as an ecosystem with them. Ideally, what we want to do to the VMware environment is appear as a black box. And one of the nice parts about Shortest Path Bridging is it has immense geographic reach, guys. It's not like Trill in that sense, where Trill is really a glasshouse protocol. This stuff can reach across states. We have whole states that are wired with SPB. We have cross-continental links with SPB. So geographic reach comes part and parcel with the technology. And that becomes very amenable to a geodistant data center approach, because now I can use SPB as the actual data center interconnect, and then we can become a black box to the NSX environment. If they require the ability to establish circuits across, then we actually do that in a subservient fashion to the NSX environment. And to them, they look at VXLAN end-to-end. They really don't see SPB. They don't need to see SPB. They really just need to see the NSX environment. And that's really the goal that we're trying to work towards.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, that makes absolute sense. I think that would be that'll be really interesting if that comes together. I'd love to see that.
It's a powerful vision. Stay tuned, guys.
Well, there's a lot happening in that NSX space with the overlays, and they rely on the underlying network. So NSX has approached SDN is to do everything in the software at this point in time, and they rely on the underlay to be reliable and stable, and that's what you're looking to build. And, you know, in previous shows, I think we've talked about how Fabric Connect can form a really good Ethernet fabric that sits underneath any sort of overlay technology, and NSX is just one of those.
That's right. That's right. Mm. We just view them as one of the ecosystem. Another thing to consider, though, guys, is that there are some times where you just want to keep things separate, and security really – a good example is multicast. Anyone who's dealt with multicast knows that keeping track of the address usage is key. One of the last things you want are two sources in the network sending to the same Class D address. Layer 3 stealth actually allows us to create these self-contained multicast environments. So I can have IPTV distribution. I can have a video surveillance solution. Both of them can be multicast, but they are ships in the night. They never see one another. I never have the danger of a video surveillance camera being seen on the corporate television, and I don't have the danger of the IPTV environment, you know, interfering with the performance of the video surveillance environment. And then also, I have the ability to reuse the Class D address, and I can do that again and again and again just by simply creating additional stealth networks.
Sure. Yep. Because classic separation and the reuse of IP addresses, because they can't see each other, so there's no chance they're going to collide or cause a duplicate.
Yeah. And that's a hidden benefit. Many of our hospital customers have realized this. And as you guys know, in healthcare, if you're not buying somebody, you're being bought. Okay. Acquisitions are just common.
Or you're offering services. Or more complicated, you're offering services to the doctors in your hospitals. Because
yes.
The doctors want the hospitals to do everything for them, yeah.
Yes. And what they found is that when they acquire these new hospitals, inevitably they have their 172 nets, their 10 nets, so forth, so on. And it used to take weeks and weeks and weeks worth of planning to ingest assimilate a hospital into the Borg. So it's a very difficult task. What they found with stealth technologies is that they can incorporate a relationship with a customer. They can have a net demarcation and people can keep on using their 10 nets, and they can ingest a hospital in a matter of days now. And then after the fact, they can look at readdressing. So it allows them to streamline the acquisition.
Yeah, as someone who deals with a network that happens to connect a bunch of hospitals together, I can tell you that exact challenge is very real. Every time I turn around, there's more overlapping RFC 1918 address space. Oh, I can't route that block for you. We're gonna NAT. That's what we're gonna do.
And
that's
nothing gets you a pay better. Rise like saying, you know, if we had IPv6.
Oh, in a hospital, they don't want to hear it. Yeah, but my MRI device in the corner doesn't do IPv6, so I can't. You know, and on and on. The FDA
that's right.
won't
it
approve
hasn't been
that.
Updated in 5 years, probably, but.
It'll get there sooner or later. It's, you know, one of the areas of expertise I have is IPv6, and I keep on saying, my day will come someday, but we'll see. Maybe I'll retire first.
Oh, I've got a saying around that one. Too young to throw in the towel and too old to pick it up.
I like that. I think I fit in that category.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I know IPv6 is going to be a thing, but it just, you know, there'll be a tipping point and it's going to be like I'm sitting there under an avalanche thing looking at it going, why doesn't that fall down? And then it's going to fall on top of me.
Sorry.
Really? It's really sort of thing.
And I wanted to go back to something you were talking about earlier in the show, and you had mentioned that the devices in a shortest path bridging domain are able to they maintain a stateful replicated database amongst themselves. Can you talk a little bit about that? I'm curious about how that works.
Sure. Ethan, basically, shortest path bridging uses ISIS, which is integrated system, basically the protocol that we know and love from OSI. Mm-hmm. The difference, though, is that ISIS in shortest path bridging really never moves a packet. It's used explicitly as a control plane. And it uses the type length values, which are instantiated with ISIS, usually, which is used to advertise routes and things of that nature. Instead, what we use it is a services programming language. So ISIS handles a number of things through these type length values. First of all, the topology of the network.
Well, just hang on just a second there. So the TLVs in ISIS, you can define a new TLV to do whatever you want and have the community agree to it and then kind of move ahead with it. So ISIS is kind of extensible in the sorts of information it can carry in that way.
Exactly why it was selected, because we look at the TLV library is basically a very good, rich repository that can be pulled on, because we did pull some older TLVs out of the mix and use them for the topology and then also some IP routing capabilities. But beyond that, we really did a lot of updates. And that's really what RFC 6329 covers is the type length values that are defined with an ISIS. Draft Unbehagen takes it further with TLVs to define IP, layer 3 VSNs, and then also multicast as well. The value of these type length values is that they program the database environment, and they will deterministically indicate how traffic should be replicated. So when someone sends a promiscuous frame into the network, and this is typically referred to as the BUM classification, broadcast unknown multicast. Mm-hmm. Well, if you read RFC 6329, it uses something called tandem replication. And tandem replication is just what it says. You have a daisy chaining and establishment of a tree, all according to the Dijkstra. And the Dijkstra tree obviously indicates the shortest path across the network. And at the lowest level, ICIDs are always tree entities. They're always tree entities. This is the thing you need to keep in mind. Point-to-point communication is only a subset of that tree. And that's part of the magic of SPB, is these trees are instantiated instances in the database. So one of the things that we do is we actually embed in the destination multicast address within the actual shortest path bridging frame, we actually embed not only the source, in other words, where the actual multicast or flood is ingressing into the network, but also the circuit that that service is associated with. So now what happens is I can actually take an ARP, for instance, and I can take that and translate it. First of all, am I allowing you to do this on the network? Okay, I am. So now I allow you to communicate. But when you send that ARP out, it stays within the scope of the constrained service, and it's statefully replicated. This is another thing that we do with IP multicast, and it's one of the reasons why we can scale so high in the multicast counts, is we're not using hop-by-hop reverse path forwarding trees for multicast within SPB. We're using these instantiated circuits, these ICIDs, in order to deliver the service.
Yeah, it's not a PIM routed infrastructure. It's not rendezvous points and building a tree out that way. It's I know where these multicast endpoints are, where my speakers are, and I can deterministically forward exactly where it needs to go.
That's correct. Which means that this becomes very, very amenable to multicast purposes that are critical. Good examples of that are Vocera in hospitals, where you have the nurse and they can hit a code red, code blue, code pink. Someone stole an infant. Those types of things. But also video surveillance. Many video surveillance systems are multicast. But I think you guys would both agree either one of those use cases is not like a corporate IPTV where if it goes down, it's okay. It's not an urgent thing. If Vocera goes down in a hospital environment, that's a critical issue. If a video surveillance environment goes down, that's a critical issue. These services can't go down. So that's one of the reasons why this is very amenable to those technologies.
Yeah. In other words, an Avaya fabric that's dealing with multicast in this way because of the way shortest path bridging is handling this and how the database is replicated means you end up with a very stable fabric. Actually, let me think about this because I remember seeing a demo of a whole screen full of multicast video feeds, and someone was essentially messing with the SPP fabric by plugging in and then unplugging physical cables to change the topology and what things looked like. And man, you could hardly tell that any video frames were dropped. Yes. You had to look very carefully to detect there was any interruption in service at all.
Yeah. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I was there, Ethan, that was at the network field day, correct?
Yes, it was. Yep, you're exactly right.
Yeah, that was a fun time. I remember, if you guys remember, I typed no shit on the screen. I was the guy that did that. So.
Outstanding.
That's a first on the internet, right? So that is exactly it. And one of the things that we've realized is that this technology, not only can we scope and segment this stuff, because we're not using IP and we're not dependent on IP as a pathing protocol, we can use it and advertise it. I'm talking about IP. We can use it and keep it hidden. In other words, just run it through the stealth infrastructure. IP is still used as a protocol, but it's not there. Or in the case of the SCADA networks, we don't need any IP at all, and we just don't run anything. It's just a simple Ethernet switch path for the SCADA protocol. So there's several different modes of stealth that we can do to actually keep services not only segmented but invisible.
So, Ed, just to wrap up that big idea there, ISIS is not used to, strictly as a routing protocol that's determining how to push traffic through the SPB fabric with shortest path computation. I mean, there's that element of it, but really it's also got these TLVs that have been defined, since you can define whatever TLVs you'd like ISIS to carry, and it's got a bunch of information in there related to where endpoints are on the network and what services that they are mapped to, and therefore you can build a deterministic forwarding path through the fabric in that way.
That's correct. So you'd look at ISIS as, rather than being a routing protocol in this instance, we use it more as a programming construct.
Yes. Okay.
Well, I think we've just about taken this as far as we can go, because at the end of the day, the security track is a very boring and tedious one. And next thing you know, the security consultants are going to be lining up asking not just for their pound of flesh, but and also to the ability to say, no, you can't change anything. So let's call it there and say that's it for the show this week, and say thanks for listening to The Packet Pushers, and thanks to Avaya for sponsoring the show and supporting The Packet Pushers. Now, we will, of course, be returning with the show again in a week or so make sure you come back. I'd like to thank Ed Kohler for joining us today. Ed, tell people where they can find you on the internet.
Yes. Well, first of all, thank you for having me, guys. And secondly, I am available on the internet. I do have a YouTube channel. If you search on Ed Kohler, that's K-O-E-H-L-E-R, I have a YouTube channel that actually goes through a lot of the technology that we discussed here. I also have a blog site at www.edkohler.wordpress.com. And the most recent article that I wrote is on data science and analytics.
Just to get out of the box there. Okay, well, we'll make sure that those things get put into the blog post to go with the show notes for today. So in the show notes, we'll have some links to various pieces. We've got some presentations here that I think that we'll load up with the blog post, that you can download them and see them. Mr. Banks, what's up with you this week?
What's up with me? I'm getting ready for a Tech Field Day event coming up next week, and then it's Interop to New York. And actually, before this recording started, I was working on my slide deck regarding active data centers, which I'll be presenting in New York, the last week of September, first week of October there. And you're going to be there too, I believe.
Yes, so I'll be joining you at Interop. And next week I'll be in San Francisco as well. I'll be there for the Intel's Developer Forum. So we won't, I don't know if we'll actually get to meet. We might, hopefully.
There's Caltrain between us. We can probably work something out. We'll see how it goes.
I think we probably can. But yes, I am looking forward to Interop. I've been working hard on my Interop presentations, polishing, brushing them up, flushing all the color schemes to make sure they all match. I've got a new font that I want to show off. No, you love me with my fonts.
I love you and your fonts, yeah.
Nice. Nice. An artist at work.
But yes, no, looking forward to Interop in New York. It's a great conference because it's a little bit smaller than the Las Vegas show and much more intimate. I don't know if I get to see a lot more people and spend more face time. If you are coming, please do come along. We actually have a blog post over on the Packet Pushers talking about that event, and I'm sure that we'll catch up there. Where can people find you, Mr. Banks?
You can find me on Twitter at ECBanks or my blog, EthanCBanks.com, which you can jump off from there to find any of the content that I'm writing at Network Computing. I'm doing some guest writing on the AVIC Networks blog and other places.
Marvelous. And, of course, I'm Greg Farrow. You can find me on my blog at EtherealMind.com or on the Twitter is at EtherealMind. We'd love to hear your feedback about today's show, so do send email to packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you are thinking. Alternatively, you can check out the podcast website at packetpushers.net, leave comments on today's show, follow us on the Twitter is at packetpushers, and it'll leave questions. And if there's anything there that you'd like to ask indirectly, so if you don't want to get in contact with directly, ask a comment there and we'll get the guys to drop in and answer your questions and maybe even take it offline. And as always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.